7. And meanwhile, the superb hand-wrought speech, untouched, remained in Joseph Adams' briefcase. Lindblom remained, shakily lighting a cigarette and trying not to involve himself, for the moment, in further conversation. He had had enough. He remained because he was too exhausted to go. "You have it in your power," Adams said as he seated himself at his desk, opened his briefcase and got out his speech, "to get me picked off." "I know," Lindblom muttered. Walking toward the door, Adams said, "I'm going to vac this. Get it to the Sim and on tape, and then the hell with it. Then, what do we call the new project, this forging of non-Terran artifacts to put a man in prison whose whole life is devoted to seeing that decent housing is..." "The Nazis," Lindblom interrupted, "had no written orders regarding the final solution, the genocide of the Jews. It was done orally, told by superior to subordinate, handed down by word of mouth. If you don't object to an absurd mixed metaphor, you probably do." "Let's go have a cup of coffee," Adams said. Lindblom shrugged. "What the hell? They've decided it's Runcible. Who are we to say it isn't? Show me. Conjure up someone else who would benefit by tipping off tanks." "I'd be glad to," Adams said, and saw Lindblom look disconcerted. "Any one of the thousands of tankers living in Runcible's Conneps. All it would take would be one who got away, wasn't picked up by Bros's agents or footmen, made his way back to his own ant tank. Then, from it, contacted a neighboring tank. Then from that tank to..." "Yeah," Lindblom agreed, stolidly. "Sure, why not? Except, would his fellow tankers let him back into his tank? Wouldn't they think he was hot or had... what name did we make up to call it? The bag plague. They'd massacre him on sight, because they believe the reading matter we give them on TV every damn day of the week and twice on Saturday night, just in case. They'd think he was a living missile. And anyhow, there's more you don't know. You ought to hand over a few bucks to the Foot organization now and then. Pick up a little inside news. These tankers that had been tipped off about conditions up here, they weren't tipped off by anybody they knew. It wasn't one of their own members coming back. Okay, the tanker couldn't reach his own tank, so instead..." "They got it," Lindblom said. "Over the coax." For a moment, Adams failed to understand. He stared at Lindblom. "That's right," Lindblom said. "On their TV set, for about 1 minute, and very feeble, but enough." "Good God," Adams said, and he thought, "there are millions of them down there. What would it be like if someone cut into the main coax, the chief, sole, and central trunk from Estes Park that reaches all the tanks? What would it be like to have the earth open and millions of humans imprisoned subsurface for 15 years, believing in a radioactive waste above, with missiles and bacteria and rubble and warring armies? The domain system would sustain a death blow, and the great park over which he flapped twice daily would become a densely populated civilization once more. Not quite as before the war, but close enough. Roads would reappear. Cities. And, ultimately, there would be another war." That was the rationale. The masses had egged their leaders on to war in both West Dam and Pack Peep. But once the masses were out of the way, stuffed down below into antiseptic tanks, the ruling elite of both East and West were free to conclude a deal. Although, strangely, in a sense, it had not been them at all. Not Bros, not General Holt, who had been C&C of West Dam, or even Marshal Harenzany, the top officer in the hierarchy of Soviet brass. But the fact that both Holt and Harenzany knew when it was time to use the missiles, and had done so, and when time had come to quit, this was all true, and without it, without their joint reasonability, peace would not have been possible. But underneath this collaboration of the two top military men lay something else, something which to Adams was real and strange and, in a sense, deeply moving. The Recon Dis-In Council of Leadys in Mexico City, Ameca-Meca. It had assisted in the job of forcing peace on the planet, and as a governing body, a final arbiter, it had not gone away. Man had built a weapon that could think for itself, and after it had thought a while, 2 years in which vile destruction had occurred, with the leadys locked hip and thigh each with the other, two huge artificial armies from two land masses, advanced varieties of leadys, who had been constructed with an eye toward utilizing their analytical brains for planning tactics and finally overall strategy. These advanced types, the 10, 11, and 12 varieties, had figured out that the best strategy was something which the Phoenicians had learned 5,000 years ago. It was summed up, Adams reflected, in the Mikado. If merely saying that a man had been executed was enough to satisfy everyone, why not merely say it instead of doing it? The problem was really, to the advanced leadys, that simple. They were not Gilbert and Sullivan buffs, and Gilbert's words were not in their artificial brains. The text of the Mikado had not been programmed into them as operational data, but they had arrived at the same conclusion, and had in addition acted on it in conjunction with Marshal Harenzini and CNC General Holt. Aloud, Adams said, "But they didn't see the advantage." "Pardon?" Lindblom murmured, still shaky, still unwilling to engage in any more talk. He looked tired. "What the Recon Dis-End Council didn't see," Adams said, "and can't see now, because there's no libido component to their percept-mentation systems, is that the maxim, why execute someone?" "Ah, shut up," Lindblom said, and turning, stalked out of Joseph Adams' office, leaving him standing there alone, speech in hand, idea in mind, doubly frustrated. But he could hardly blame Lindblom for being upset, because all the Yance men had this streak. They were selfish. They had made the world into their deer park at the expense of the millions of tankers below. It was wrong, and they knew it, and they felt guilt. Not quite enough guilt to cause them to knock off Bros and let the tankers up, but enough guilt to make their late evenings a thrashing agony of loneliness, emptiness, and their nights impossible. And they knew that if anyone could be said to be amending the crime committed, the theft of an entire planet from its rightful owners, it was Louis Runcible. They gained by keeping the tankers down, and he gained by luring them up. The Yance Man elite confronted Runcible as an antagonist, but one whom they knew deep down inside was morally in the right. It was not a sanguine feeling, at least not to Joe Adams, as he stood alone in his office, gripping his superb speech, which was to be vacked, run through the SAM, taped, then castrated from Bros's office. This speech, it did not tell the truth, but it was not a pastiche of clichés, lies, bromides, euphemisms, and more sinister ingredients, which Adams had noticed in speeches dreamed up by his fellow Yance men. After all, he was only one speechwriter from among a pack. Carrying his highly prized new speech, so regarded by him, anyhow, in the absence of a contrary consensual validation, he left his office and by express elevator dropped to the floor where Megavac 6B chugged away. Floors, rather, in that the total works of the organism had undergone accretive changes over the years, refinements that had added to it whole new parts occupying entire new layers. Megavac 6V was huge, but in contrast, the sim itself remained the same as always. Two uniformed toughs, Bros's hand-picked but oddly effete, physiognomically dainty roughnecks, eyed him as he emerged from the elevator. They knew him. They understood that his presence on Megavac 6V's programming floor was mandatory in view of his job. He approached the keyboard of Megavac 6V, saw that it was in use. Another Yance man, unfamiliar to him, was whacking away at the keys like a virtuoso pianist at the end of a Franz Liszt opus, with double octaves and all. Everything but hammering with the fist. Above the Yance man, his written copy was suspended, and Adams gave in to the impulse. He moved close to inspect it. At once, the Yance man ceased typing. "Sorry," Adams said. "Let's see your authorization." The Yance man, quite dark, youthful, and small, with almost Mexican-like hair, held out his hand peremptorily. Sighing, Adams got out of his briefcase the memo from Geneva, from Bros's bureau, entitling him to vac this particular speech. The document had a stamped code number, entered on the memo as well. The dark, small Yance man compared the document with the memo, seemed satisfied, returned both to Adams. "I'll be through in 40 minutes." The youth resumed typing. so bounce off and leave me alone. His tone was neutral but forbidding. Adams said, I rather like your style. He had quickly, briefly scanned the page of script on top. It was good stuff, unusually so. Again, the ants man ceased typing. You're Adams. Once more he extended his hand, this time for shaking purposes. They shook then, and the strained atmosphere reduced to a tolerable level. But there was always the I'm bigger than you competitiveness in the air when two Yants men met, either away from the agency or at their domains or here right on the job. It always made the day just that much tougher to get through, and yet Adams thrived on it. If not, he realized, he would long since have gone under. You've done some good pieces. I've watched the final tapes. Studying him with his sharp, bright, black, deeply set Mexican-type eyes, the young Yants man said, But a lot of your work has been axed at Geneva, or so I hear. Well, Adams said stoically, it's either axed or it's co-axed in this business. There's no such thing as half-transmitting. You want to bet? The youth's tone was brittle, penetrating. It disconcerted Adams. Guardedly, because, after all, both of them, in essence, were competing for the same prize, Adams said, I suppose a jejune, watered-down speech could be considered. Let me show you something. The dark young Yants man rose, yanked shut the master circuit breaker so that the vac began processing what he had fed it up to now. Together, Adams and the dark young Yants man walked over to view the sim. There it sat, solemnly, at its large oak desk, with the American flag behind it. In Moscow, another and identical sim sat, with a duplicate of Megavac 6V, the flag of the USSR, behind it. Otherwise everything, the clothes, the gray hair, the competent, fatherly, mature but soldierly features, the strong chin. It was the same sim all over again, both having been built simultaneously in Germany, wired by the finest Yantsman technicians alive. And here maintenance men perpetually skulked, watching with trained, narrow eyes for any sign of failure, even a fraction of a second hesitation. Anything which might mitigate the quality striven for, that of free and easy authenticity. This simulacrum, out of all which they, the Yantsmen, were involved in, required the greatest semblance of the actuality which it mimicked. A breakdown here, Adams realized soberly, however minute, would be catastrophic. Like the time its left hand, in reaching out, a huge red warning light on the wall lit. A buzzer buzzed. A dozen main men for the simulacrum materialized to scrutinize. Catastrophic, as the time the reaching left hand went into a spasm of pseudo-Parkinsonism, a neural motor tremor, indicating, had the tapes been put on the cable, the insidious start of senility. Yes, that would have been the tanker's interpretation, most probably. He's getting old, they would have muttered to each other as they sat in their communal halls, overseen by their polcoms. Look, he's shaky. The strain. Remember Roosevelt. The strain of the war got him finally. It'll get the protector. And then what'll we do? But it hadn't been put on the coaxial cable, of course. The tankers had never seen that sequence. The sim had been opened up, thoroughly gone over, tested and checked and certified. A miniaturized component had been spat on, denounced as the malefactor. And at a workbench in one of the shops of Runcible's Conaps, a workman had been quietly relieved of his duties and possibly his life, without ever knowing why or what. Because in the first place, he had known what the tiny output coil or diode or just plain thing had been used for. The sim began to move. And Joseph Adams shut his eyes, standing as he was out of range of the cameras, hidden with his small, dark, very young but expert Yants man, the author of the words about to be uttered. Maybe it'll go out of its mind, Adams thought wildly, and began to recite pornographic ballads. Or like one of those antique disc records of the previous century. Repeat a word, repeat a word, repeat a word. My fellow Americans, the sim said in its firm, familiar, near hoarse but utterly controlled voice. To himself, Joseph Adams said, Yes, Mr. Yancey. Yes, sir.